This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
All right, 3, 2, 1. Hi, this is William Ramsey. Welcome to William Ramsey Investigates. On tonight's show, I have a returning guest, a very special guest. We've done two interviews in the past. Today is February 28th, 2020. Our first interview was done on June 14th, 2019, and we covered the suspicious death of Stuart Lubbock in the pool of Michael Barrymore, a well-known TV presenter in the UK. It took place in the actual finding of Stuart Lubbock's body on the early morning. It took place in March 2001, but there's been updates, and we'll talk about that in a sec. And then I did another interview with Anthony Bennett, January 17th, 2020. We talked about Operation Tiberius and police corruption in the UK. But we're going to return to the subject of Michael Barrymore, because there was a documentary that just came out in February in the UK on Channel 4. The title of the documentary was Body in the Pool. And I think it's important to kind of revisit this. It's also a case that really piqued my interest because how similar it was to what we call here in the States the smiley face killers, where these young men, Stuart Lubbock was 31. He didn't really look 31, in my opinion, but, you know, where these young men suspiciously end up in water. So we can talk about that in more detail. But Anthony Bennett, are you there?
Yes, good evening.
Good evening. How are you?
Great. Yeah, very good.
Good. So for people who don't know about your background or haven't listened to the first two interviews we did, maybe you can talk a little bit about your background and how you became interested in the case of Stuart Lubbock and Michael Barrymore.
Well, this all began for me in 2006. I had been a solicitor for a number of years and then got a job with the UK Independence Party, which is the party that for years and years slaved away trying to get us out of the European Union. And in the end, our campaign succeeded. The party was led by Nigel Farage, which I think is a name quite well known in America now, since he's a pal of President Trump.
Yes, I would agree with that, yes.
Anyway, when that work finished, very shortly afterwards, Terry Lubbock, who lived in Harlow, where I used to live, had spotted that he's the father, obviously, of Stuart Lubbock, spotted that Michael Barrymore was making another attempt to revive his career on a program called Celebrity Big Brother. And this is a British version of reality TV, Big Brother being a place where people go on and are filmed for the course of a week, and then people drop out, and the last man in, as it were, or the last woman in, gets some kind of gong.
Yeah, they have something like that in the States. They have a Big Brother version in the States.
Yeah, but this was Celebrity Big Brother, so he was on there with some other celebrities, one of whom was George Galloway, an MP in the British Parliament. Those two were the main celebrities. And what happened was I opened my newspaper, weekly newspaper in Harlow, and there was a front page headline about Barrymore coming back on Celebrity Big Brother to promote his career or to relaunch it. And there was another plea from the distraught father saying, you know, I can't live with this. I can't tolerate this man reviving his career. I need help. I need help in getting this man to account for his crimes. And at that point, having followed the case in the local paper for years and wanted to help, I wrote to him. And of course, I explained I was a former solicitor and be pleased to help him. And we met. And the introduction to the case was this, that I tried to think of a way of bringing this out into the open. And so what I did was I brought a private prosecution, or attempted to bring a private prosecution, because when Terry showed me the papers, it revealed a number of offences, criminal offences, mainly drugs, the use of drugs, the possession of drugs, the supply of drugs. So I attempted to get a private prosecution going. And although that failed within 2 or 3 weeks, it attracted a huge amount of publicity. And following that, I researched the case in depth. And to cut a long story short, and obviously we covered this in the previous broadcast, I realized, of course, that he had been killed through a violent rape by one or more men. And I also discovered, and I stick to this viewpoint to today, that although the press and the media and the police all said that the body was found in the pool, I was certain in my own mind that it wasn't, that it never had been in the pool. And I may have gone over this last time. I can certainly explain why again to you now. But I was absolutely certain that the body had never been in the pool. And then, of course, I wrote a book with Terry Lubbock. We wrote a book jointly called Not a White, Getting Away with Murder. And in that book, we developed the theory that the whole idea of him being found drowned in the pool was a complete hoax.
Right. Sorry to interrupt, but for people who don't know, a white was kind of like Barrymore's catchphrase. So it's kind of like, it was, all right, yeah. But a white, he would say that often. Sorry.
Yeah, he would talk to his audience, and he would start off by saying, all white at the back, all white, are we? And of course, the audience would roar back, yes, we're all right. So that was why we used the title, Not a White.
Gotcha. Also, when he was trying to revive his career, Michael Barrymore, he was on the Celebrity Big Brother with none other than Dennis Rodman. And who of all people show up but Jimmy Savile, right? Did you see that part of it?
Do you know, was Jimmy Savile on it as well? That's
He was not actually a member of Celebrity Big Brother, but he was a celebrity guest. So he is... Yes. Hamming it up with Galloway and Barrymore. It's really incredible.
Yes.
And Dennis
You're
Rodman.
Quite right.
Yeah. Sorry, just wanted to
add that. You'll have to remind me about Dennis Rodman. His name rings a bell.
He was the basketball player on the Chicago Bulls, so he was kind of like one of the superstar rebound members of the teams with Michael Jordan.
Yeah, yeah.
But also kind of a semi-celebrity, too. Yeah.
This was not by no means the first attempt to revive his career. I would think there's been probably about 7, 8, or 9 altogether. A few months after the killing of Stuart Lubbock, he attempted to revive his career by a run at the Wyndham Theatre in London. He had his own show, which I think was promoted by somebody called Bill Kenworthy. And Bill Kenworthy is the manager of Everton Football Club, one of the directors of the Everton Football Club, one of the big football clubs over here, and is a somebody who arranges shows and puts on shows and plays and this sort of thing, a very big figure in the entertainment world. And he's significant in this case because for a time Barrymore lived with Bill Kenworthy. So that was one attempt, the Wyndham Theatre. And then he went on a long TV interview with somebody called Martin Bashir, who is one of our expert interviewers over here in England. And it was a long, rather morbid interview in which he was wallowing in self-pity and saying, poor me, and trying to pretend that he had seen Stuart in the pool and had run away and got help. And, of course, that was all fiction. And the program is memorable for me because he came out with a line sometime in that program. I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired. It's obviously rehearsed, but that kind of illustrates how he was attempting to gain sympathy, I think.
I see. Yeah, Martin Bashir is somewhat known here. He's done some confrontational interviews here. Like Robert Downey Jr. walked out on him. He asked him a bunch of questions about doing drugs. So he's somewhat known here, much like Piers Morgan, who actually used to have a show on CNN, who we can talk about in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as Barrymore, so, I mean, he's still, what's his kind of situation now. You know, well, actually, why don't we talk about Dead in the Pool and its impact upon public opinion?
Yeah, let's talk about the documentary. But I mean, before that, I can just say that he has never had a successful run in any of his attempts to revive his career. One-off shows, interviews on TV, hopefully leading to something, but it's never got him anywhere. And he's occasionally been pictured working in a friend's market garden somewhere in Essex, I think. So, you know, he's not got an obvious source of income these days. But William, coming to the Body in the Pool, this was a documentary that has just gone out, about an hour and a half long. And it told the story, really, from the even before the death of Stuart Lubbock, highlighted Barrymore's very successful career. Then it went through the various aspects of the killing of Stuart Lubbock, and lots of film of media personalities. Funnily enough, a lot of media personalities who were involved in the story were allowed to have their say. The documentary was around about 18 to 21 months in the making because the makers of the film contacted me early on and asked for information and all the witness statements, the pathology reports, the inquest transcript, all of those sorts of things. And I was very pleased to help them. And I thought it would be a breakthrough, this film, because I gave them my book. I explained the theory. I explained how the various people who had said that Stuart had died in the pool had clearly lied, because their stories were inconsistent, in fact, major contradictions between them. They couldn't make up their mind who actually found Stuart. They couldn't make up their mind who dived in to fetch him from the pool. They couldn't make up their mind whether to... whether he was floating at the top of the pool face down or floating at the bottom of the pool face up. There are all these massive contradictions. And I said to the documentary makers, I hope you're going to make a film which really comes up with the answer and really comes up with the events of that night and how they unfolded. And to that extent, it was a grave disappointment to me. And briefly, if I can explain why, these reasons, I think. First of all, the title of the film was, the documentary was Barrymore, Body in the Pool, which immediately, to my mind, perpetuated the myth that he was ever found in the pool. So I was very disappointed with that. If any of your people over there see this documentary, and of course it's available on the internet, another major feature of it, a huge amount of footage of the pool itself. One of the reasons for that is that the police obviously released to the documentary makers their original film of the scene of the crime, which was taken early-ish in the morning after Stuart Lubbock had died. And so there was much footage of the pool throughout. And it was, to my mind, it was very likely subliminal. The title of the film, Body in the Pool, and all these images of the pool would fix in most people's minds that he really was in the pool. Right. The documentary makers made no mention whatsoever of the book that we'd written. They made no mention whatsoever of even the theory that he might not have been in the pool at all. And on top of that, and this is one of the good things about the interview we did a year or so ago, we did cover quite well the actual events of that night. I think I talked to you through the events from Barrymore meeting with Stuart Lubbock, the way the various party guests came to the home, the events of that night, the Stuart Lubbock and Jonathan Kenny and Justin Merritt getting into the jacuzzi, which is, I think, a critical moment in the evening. Kylie Merritt plying them all with drink and drugs and what have you. And then the inexplicable period of hour and three quarters, if you like, the missing hour and three quarters before the alarm was raised at 5:45 in the evening. Now, you would think that a documentary furnished with, I mean, I gave them the witness statements, they've had a copy of my book, you would think that they would take people through all the events of that night if they were going to do a documentary on that night. But there was nothing. Only just tangential references. There was no story there.
No specifics, right? No specifics about the time and dates.
Very few specifics, yes. So to give you an example, one of the crucial pieces of evidence in the whole case was that swimming pool cover, the main swimming pool, ever opened before Stuart Lubbock died? Now, just to create the scene here, outside Barrymore had he had a jacuzzi on the terrace, a hot water jacuzzi, which was in operation that night. Hot water available, all at the ready. And just beyond that was a medium-sized swimming pool, which I think I told you before had never been used that winter. In fact, I'm not sure if it had ever been used at all. It was fairly new, but certainly it had never been used that winter. And again, taking your listeners to the scene, we're talking about events at 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock in the morning on March the 31st, the 1st of April. The outside temperature, we know from meteorological records, was no more than 5 degrees centigrade or 41 Fahrenheit. So the idea that anybody in their right mind would actually want to go diving into that pool on such a cold morning is fairly ludicrous. But the Barrymore and his helpers, I believe, concocted the story that they had pulled back the pool cover early in the evening and heated it up during that evening. It was an extremely unlikely story. But again, this documentary didn't touch on that at all. Such a crucial thing, but they never mentioned it.
Interesting. Yeah, it is available online, but they seem to focus on his celebrity, you know, really his background and that. Did you find that to be off-putting?
I found it to be irrelevant, basically. You know, I wanted them to get to the story, to the meat and bones. I didn't want to hear News of the World staff give their take on the events and the other journalists. It just seemed to me that that was to occupy 90 minutes of a documentary and really was telling things that people already know, really. I did take exception to, let me just briefly tell you about one of the people who appeared in that documentary was somebody called Antonella Lazzeri, who is a leading journalist for the Sun newspaper. I'll tell you why I feel aggrieved at her appearing in the film, because no sooner had there been the original publicity on the case after we tried on the private prosecution, I got a call from Antonella Lazzeri at the Sun newspaper, which was then the best-selling newspaper in the country and was until recently. And she said, "Look, Mr. Bennett, we're very interested in what you've got to say, and I understand you've got all these witness statements and pathology reports. Can we see them? We'd like to help Terry." And I was a bit more naive then than I am now. And I said, "Of course, you know, you're very welcome. I'll just need to copy them and then you can have them." So they took them away, leaving me with the impression that they were going to help Terry Lubbock by exposing what really went on that night. And it's all there, of course, in the witness statements and the pathology reports. It's all really very plain when you look at it. What then happened was that all of a sudden, Terry Lubbock disappeared without trace for a few days, didn't know where he was. And I then, on the Monday morning following, there was a five-page story, a front page, and the next five or six pages in the Sun, saying expert reports put Barrymore in the clear. And what they'd done is they had really manufactured a story that there was no evidence that Stuart had suffered any injury in the pool, but in fact he must have been injured in the hospital by a hospital thermometer. And there was several pages of commentary on the witness statements and the pathology reports, which completely reversed the truth, totally reversed the truth. It was the whole story was designed to help Michael Barrymore. In addition to that, I discovered that the team from The Sun had put Terry up in a swanky hotel in London for 4 days with minders. He wasn't allowed to have any contact with me or anybody else. And they, as part of the deal, he was to meet with Michael Barrymore. And on the front page of The Sun that on that particular Monday was Terry Lubbock standing side by side with Michael Barrymore with a caption underneath from Terry saying, "I forgive you." Now, can you imagine how I felt having begun to expose this this murder and the cover-up? 5 or 6 pages in Britain's leading newspaper with Terry on the front page forgiving Michael Barrymore and a completely story, I mean, a load of crock, really, right. Claiming that Michael Barrymore had nothing to do with the events of that night and that Stewart must have been injured by a hospital thermometer.
Yeah, it's remarkable. When did that story come out? When did that story...
Back in January 2006. I mean, the events moved very quickly. We had a court hearing. Then there was a summons issued on Michael Barrymore. And immediately after that, all these events I'm talking about happened within 2 or 3 weeks. The Sun was very anxious, obviously, to get in on the act straight away. And they used the information I'd given them to completely distort the whole story. And really, ever since, that the media as a whole have been like this, with the single exception of the News of the World, which was another popular newspaper, which the associate editor there looked at my material, and he knew Barrymore very well, by the way. He often talked to Michael Barrymore, but he knew that instinctively that the my analysis was correct, and he did actually serialise my book in the News of the World for 2 weeks, which was great.
Well, that's remarkable. And then, why do you think that so many of these media entities are willing to distort or twist, you know, what the real reality, even up to kind of body in the pool, the fact that they didn't, you know, that they ignored certain specifics about that night? Why do you think that's taking place?
I think because there is something akin to a club into which celebrities belong, and they, generally speaking, they look after themselves. There's a kind of unwritten understanding that they will support each other, even when they're in a downtime or having bad luck. They will support each other. And besides that, most of these celebrities have got money. They've got lawyers. They've got public relations officers working for them. And they've got money, and they've also got, I believe, and this is relevant, I think, to this case, William, and others that I've studied, I believe they have corrupt police officers on the inside. And I would say to you that this hoax, the drowning hoax, could only have been sustained by the police deliberately allowing evidence to be lost and deliberately not dealing with the obvious facts of the case, which that they had all lied completely. But I believe there was corruption in this case.
Right. So, I mean, if all of the people who were there that night are telling contradictory stories that don't fit together, why aren't the police able to, get one of them and try to break them down and try to get the truth of things, you know, like a standard police investigation? And then did Barrymore have all of those things? Did he have PR people, lawyers, intimidating people, or people trying to get the story out?
Without a doubt, yes, without a doubt. He had, like I said, he talked to newspaper editors regularly. I mean, these celebrities depend on publicity. So he and his PR men would talk to to the press regularly and try and get their celebrities talked about. Just going back to the events of that evening, that morning, the police took the statements from the six key witnesses over a period of 2 or 3 days. One of the stories was so ridiculous that the young man had, I think it was James Futters, he had to change his story completely. And even then it contradicted what the other said about where he was found, how he was found, who found him, all that kind of thing. And one of the things that was featured in my book, but not covered in this program, The Body in the Pool, was that Michael Barrymore's manager arrived on the scene well before the police were called. That's in the witness statement. Some of the two girl witnesses saw Mike Brown, Michael Barrymore's manager, disposing of items, throwing drugs down the toilet, and that kind of thing before the police were called. So Michael Barrymore's manager lived very close by, and he lived, by the way, just opposite the what we call the Major Crimes Unit in Essex. He lived right across the road from the police, and I think it's fairly certain that Barrymore had connections with Essex Police.
Interesting. So what do you think the impact and the fallout is of this documentary, Body in the Pool?
Well, one of the main results of the program is that Essex Police were rather dragged into doing something, if you follow me. The police have done nothing since 2007, when they, following the dossier I produced in the book, they arrested Michael Barrymore, Jonathan Kenny and Justin Merritt on suspicion of murder. This was in June 2007, so going back 13 years. That didn't get anywhere. There was insufficient evidence to proceed against any three of them. And the police have been silent ever since. They've not done nothing. I think what's happened here is these documentary makers have got some form. They're well-respected documentary makers with a track record. And they obviously must have talked to police and worked with the police on this documentary. And the way the police reacted, William, was to come up with a reward, which began at £20,000 and is now standing at £40,000. Essex Police themselves have put up £20,000 for this. And an organisation called Crime Stoppers, which is a voluntary organisation here which supports the police, they've put up another £20,000. So £40,000 is on offer for anybody who can give information leading to the conviction of anybody for the murder of Stuart Lubbock. Now, that would seem on the face of it like progress, and that is one of the tangible outcomes of the program. But I can't remember how much of this we went over before, but clearly I would say that six people were involved in the cover-up and know exactly what happened to Stuart and would die before they would give any evidence about that. And they are, of course, Michael Barrymore, his lover Michael, Jonathan Kenny, Justin Merritt and the sister Kylie Merritt, and the two other gays from the village, James Futters and Simon Shaw. Those six are not going to talk. The only other two who might talk, the other two witnesses, are the young girls aged about 20. But we know from information disclosed by Essex Police in a recent court case that two witnesses were paid off substantial sums of money. This information was given by two informers to Essex Police. So it could be the two girls. So they and their families are unlikely to talk as well.
Sum of money disclosed? Do they know how much they were paid?
No, it wasn't. It was described as a large sum of money. I have an idea that a figure was disclosed in the court proceedings, and I can't remember it. And rather than mention it, I just simply say that it was obviously a large sum of money. I have an idea of figure. I don't want to mention it in case somebody thinks I'm exaggerating, but it was said to be a large sum of money.
I see.
And so the police's great pitch really is that somebody might have, one of these eight people might have talked to somebody else about what happened, and might now be willing to talk with the prospect of a £40,000 reward. I can't see it myself, actually. I can't really see this happening because anybody who there wasn't there on the night can't possibly know what happened. And even if they were told, how valuable would their evidence be in a court case? It would be hearsay evidence. And in any case, if somebody says, I was told that it was Michael Barrymore that raped Stuart Lubbock, or I was told that it was Jonathan Kenny, the police still have to prove that, don't they? They can't really prove it on the basis of what somebody's been told. So I think this is the police being forced to do something. I would say it's not a genuine effort to solve the case. And going back to the point you made, a very good point about the initial inquiries by the police. If the police are faced with a bunch of liars, as there was in this case, giving completely contradictory stories about how a body was allegedly found, there is an offence we have in this country called perverting the course of justice, or interfering with the course of justice. Now, without a doubt, any of these people could have been prosecuted and they could have been charged with that offence, and that might well have brought out the truth, because probably not all of those six were directly involved in the rape. But they were. The police didn't do that. They made other serious errors at the time. They didn't check the scene properly. They left the scene in the charge of Michael Barrymore's manager. So all those opportunities were lost. At the moment, I don't feel any more optimistic than I did before the program that this case will be solved.
Do you feel like it moved public opinion?
Yes, I think it did. Although I'd have to say, William, in terms of moving public opinion, the first thing I would say is that there was a Twitter storm for about 3 days in this country. There was there were three hashtags trending for 3 days. One was Stuart Lubbock, another one was Mr. Barrymore, and another was Barrymore. So there was three hashtags trending on Twitter for 3 days, huge amount of comment. So big public reaction. And looking through those, the vast majority of comments were negative towards Barrymore. Unfortunately, from my point of view, rather too many people were saying, you know, there was still the body in the pool. They still thought there was a body in the pool and that he'd been thrown in. But really, one of the best spin-offs from my point of view, and I'd like to thank you for this, is that a documentary has been made by somebody on the basis of the interview we did last time when we gave all those details. Somebody whose name I don't know has put this up, and it's had something like 40,000 views in the last 7 or 8 days. And I'm delighted with that, because if you look at the comments, there's something like 800 comments on there already. They're all saying that this little documentary based on our interview a year ago, it gives people far, far more information than in that 90 documentary that probably cost £1 million to produce. So I'm very happy with that. And I'd like to thank you for all that interview, because through that interview, this has been brought to light for a British audience.
My pleasure. I'm glad that it's out there. Glad the information's out there. And it's also kind of a warning, too, because Stuart Lubbock was, according to the information, he was formerly married and somehow got caught up in the wrong, got starstruck, it seems like, and got caught up with the wrong group of people. And it cost him his life. It's really a tragedy. It's his story.
One of the commenters on this this recent documentary that's been produced, really covering our previous interview, was he came on to say that there had been a couple of serious incidents very similar to this which the police had covered up in the past.
Wow.
I haven't made contact with him yet. I mean, I can only do so through the comments, but he did say that some broadly similar incidents has happened, which the public know nothing about. So I'd love to know more. I think he came up twice to say this. So
well, in Dead in the Pool, didn't they talk about Barrymore kind of living a scandalous life after he came out as being homosexual? I mean, I thought that he was in the tabloids there in the UK, if I remember correctly, up until 2001, March of 2001. Mm-hmm.
We know he was, there was a number of occasions when he was visited by police because there were reports of activities in hotels, not at his home, but drugs being taken. And we know that on at least a couple of occasions, three or four, I think, he was visited by police. And on one occasion, he was given a caution. And I think he was given a caution in this case as well, actually, for possession of drugs.
Right, and there was drugs on the scene, wasn't there? Cocaine on the night of the death of Stuart Levert.
One of the girls said that there was a white powder being snorted on the kitchen table. So I mentioned to the judge in the private prosecution. He said that's no evidence at all. He said I need proof of what that white substance was. He said it might have been sugar. Anyway,
yeah, it would be the first time I've ever heard of anybody at a party snorting sugar. But hey,
well, there you go. I mean, judges, they need proper evidence, of course they do, yeah. In terms of, I mean, I did write a fair amount about this in the book. I mean, there was, first of all, we know that he was regularly hunting for rent boys in London. He would call up his chauffeur, drive to a particular part of London called Charing Cross, and that would be a regular haunt for rent boys, and he'd pick them up and take them home. And he was clearly involved in regular meetings with homosexuals, and he and his friend Jonathan Kenny had a particularly riotous relationship with, what can I say, lovemaking in the open air. Well, I mean, he was really quite depraved in his activities, yes, but probably didn't cross the line into committing crimes apart from the drugs, as it were. I suppose the boys would be of the age of consent, 18.
I see.
Possibly.
How can people find your book? Because on Amazon, both in the UK and in the US, your book is priced at $507. And in the UK, it's £100. So,
Did I not explain that last time?
I think you did, but I'd just like you to repeat that just because you mentioned it.
Well, I'll just give me a minute or so to explain. When we formed the Lovett Trust, I got together with Stuart Lovett and I called in somebody I knew vaguely called Harry Seashi. And we agreed to publish this book, which I wrote, Not a White. And we formed this trust called the Lovett Trust and agreed that we would any income from the book or from the serialization of the book or any other such income would be shared equally between the three of us. As the book was published, Harry Seashi and Terry Lubbock came to me and said, well, you know, we want to sell this book ourselves. And the reason for doing that was because Harry Seashi had provided the ISBN, the International Standard Book Number. And so technically it was the publisher. I arranged absolutely everything to do with this book, wrote it, liaised with the publisher, sent off the PDFs, the whole thing, only to discover at the last minute that Harry Seashi was determined to sell this book himself. And if it is at that price on Amazon, it's Harry Seashi who's put those prices up. I was stunned that somebody could take advantage of that in that way so many years ago. And I wrote to Amazon. They said they wanted legal letters. I wrote to Harry Seashi, but there was I just gave up. I thought, well, I've done my best here. If people want to cash in and take advantage like that, I'm not going to spend money on lawyers dealing with it. So I'm very sorry indeed. Very sorry to hear that those prices are being charged. I have a few copies left. I was allowed by Harris Ishii to keep a few copies. I still have them left, and a few are available at my email address, and I'm happy to send them out.
Gotcha.
But that's the story. That's the story. It's painful to recall it, I'm afraid. It's a sad day it was, because we should have been cooperating together, the three of us. And I dare say he's given me a bad name. For some people would assume that I was profiteering from it, but absolutely not. The sale of that book has nothing to do with me and everything to do with Harry C. Sheen.
Interesting. Did you know, Barrymore put out a book back in business in 1995. Do you know of that book?
Back in Business?
Yeah, Back in Business.
Now, I'll tell you what, that 1995 rings a bell, because that was the day he came out as gay.
Well, the reason I ask that is because, you know, I've had the misfortune of doing a lot of studies into the occult, but Barrymore is making an occult hand gesture, making the sign of silence on the cover of that book. Do you recollect that?
Yes, on the back of the book. Yeah. What, my book?
No, yes. On his book, on the cover of Michael Barrymore's book in 1995, he's making a hand gesture like Alistair Crowley would make. Have you come across or sensed any kind of occultism in Barrymore or any of his associates?
I would say no, and I'm by no means unfamiliar with the occult, and I take an interest in it because I'm a Christian, and I see the occult world as anti-Christian and a very dark world out there, and I'm aware of these signs that people use, the 666 sign, and then there's the two-fingered horned salute with the second and fifth fingers. I see these signs everywhere, and also, of course, even ceremonies like the Olympics, for example, are full of occult symbols. So it's a world I know about, but I'm attuned to this. But I would have to say that nothing tangibly occult symbols or signs have ever emerged. The only thing I would say is that the man who serialized my book, Phil Taylor, in the News of the World, wrote a book about Michael Barrymore shortly before, I think it was, that...
Barrymore, A Man Possessed, right?
Yes, Barrymore, A Man Possessed.
Published now, February 2002, but...
Yeah, that was 3 years. Was it published?
That's a publication date. It doesn't mean the exact date it was really published. It could have been republished. Amazon doesn't keep original dates if they upgrade something.
Right. I would say possibly there that Phil Taylor knew Barrymore very well and would help him with stories, but would also publish stories against him if he could, you know, to sell papers. And I suspect that he used that title because he saw something in Barrymore akin to possession, spirit possession, possibly. He would have chosen that title deliberately, I think. And I have read the book. I passed it to somebody else. I have read the book. And as far as I can recall, William, I don't think he deals with anything specifically occult, but simply describes a man who was out of control, heavy drinker, drug user, addicted to gay sex, that kind of thing, but nothing tangibly occult.
On the subject of Barrymore's friends, Kenny and Merritt, has anybody done a thorough investigation of those two and their lifestyle? And I mean, one of them was a drag queen as well. Is that correct? Is that right?
Barrymore's lover that night was somebody called Jonathan Kenny. And we know he has some kind of background, certainly as a drag queen. Yes, he was active as a drag queen in the north of England for some time. He has a reputation for violence, and I think he may have been arrested, charged, and even prosecuted for at least one assault. Also quite interesting, and that very evening, before Stuart Love was murdered, and I cover this in the back of my book. There was a strange flow of phone calls between Jonathan Kenny and Michael Barrymore in the lead up to that evening, in which Jonathan Kenny was negotiating to. Now, what happened was that Michael Barrymore had been pestering him with phone calls all afternoon, and Jonathan Kenny came back to say, well, you know, let's go out for a meal this evening. Along the way, Barrymore said to him, you to sign a one of these confidentiality agreements.
Non-disclosure
agreement, that's right. And so Kenny said, well, I'm not signing a non-disclosure agreement. And Mike Brown, Michael Barrymore's manager, came on, phoned him up and said, all of Barrymore's contacts sign a non-disclosure agreement. In other words, anybody that Barrymore goes out with has to sign a non-disclosure agreement. Now, if you think of how many people Barrymore may have gone out with between 1995, coming out gay, and 2002, it must have been quite a few. So there's probably quite a few non-disclosure agreements.
Yes.
Quite a few non-disclosure agreements lying around. But it would appear that there was some tension in the air, because Barrymore later said that Kenny had become highly controlling. And there was tension, I think, that evening between the two men. And of course, it poured out later that evening when Barrymore went off with Stuart Lubbock and left Jonathan Kenny in the lurch. And Jonathan Kenny arrived at the house about an hour after Barrymore in a furious temper. And you can't help feeling that that may have played a part in the evening's events. Going back to the two Merritts, what we do know here is that Justin Merritt was a local man in Harlow. Barrymore lived in the next village to Harlow. I can say, I think, that Justin Merritt was known locally as a drug dealer, and it has been suggested that he was Michael Barrymore's supplier. Now, his sister, Kylie, played, I think, a very significant role that evening. I can't remember if we covered this before, but sometime after all the nine people had arrived at the party, either Jonathan Kenny or Michael Barrymore suggested people might like to go out to the jacuzzi. And we know, because the girls confirm it, and so I'm sure this is true, that Stuart Lovett went out to the pool. They all went stripped of their shorts, Justin Merritt and Jonathan Kenny, all in the pool together at about 4 o'clock in the morning. And also, one of the girls thought she would go to the jacuzzi and then decided against it. But Kylie Merritt was hovering around them all the time, bringing them drinks. And I suspect that Justin and Kylie Merritt was a double act.
And what do you mean by double act?
A kind of honey trap, if you like. I think it was possibly Kylie Merritt who was responsible for getting Stuart Lubbock to come to Barrymore's house that night. There was a report that she'd been seen whispering into Stuart Lubbock's ear, as if to say, look, go and get ready. We're going to go now to the party, something like that. So, you know, the coincidence of a local drug dealer and somebody who is then at the party facilitating Stuart getting into a position where perhaps he might be preyed upon by
Remarkable. That's so remarkable because, you know, I just put out my second film on this smiley face killer phenomenon. I put it out yesterday. And there's stories like that within these phenomenon where, for example, the family in Adelaide was back in the 80s, they would lure men in by using the lure of women. There would be like either transvestites acting like women or the promise of women. And there's other cases there where they think the person was last seen with a woman, gets these men who are maybe not in that particular group interest, to kind of let down their guard or follow along. That's fascinating. So that element seems to be there in the Barrymore case. That's remarkable.
Well, I think isn't this a probable scenario?
Yes.
Barrymore goes there. He's looking for somebody to get together with. It would appear that from the background I've given you, that he and his lover are not on great terms that evening. They've already been squabbling about non-disclosure agreements and things like that. So we've got Barrymore, who really isn't happy with his lover anymore. He wants somebody else that night. He's been drinking. And he sees Stuart Lubbock, and Stuart Lubbock, you have to say, is a handsome young man. Barrymore takes a fancy to him and says to Kylie, "Look, go and chat to him." Can't prove it, but this would appear to be what happened. So he's lured in. Barrymore doesn't say, "Look, come to my party." It's Kylie Merritt in the end who arranges it,
right.
And of course, she is sister of somebody who is a known drug addict in the area and who is more than likely a supplier.
Have you ever heard anything in the Barrymore case that Barrymore was interested in heterosexual men?
No.
Doesn't come up. Okay. Or anybody else, Kenny or Merritt, any of his kind of...
I am recalling now, actually, one of the things I am recalling is that he would... I do remember this. He would phone up gay chat lines and ask for somebody to come round.
Interesting.
There's some kind of gay contact line. He would ring up and say, I don't know whether he would give his name, but he would say, "Look, I need somebody." I think also he might have used those. It's coming back to me from the book Barrymore, A Man Possessed, that he would ring up and also he would just engage in talking dirty on these chat lines if he could do nothing else, So I mean, the man was addicted to gay sex, and Stuart was the victim that night.
Yeah, he was like a very high risk individual leading up to 2001. Drugs, random, cruising or whatever you would call it,
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, already had been in squabbles with the cops, already been warned.
Mm-hmm. There's one incident I mentioned in the book where he, I think he'd been performing somewhere, and he got talking to a woman and her son, and the woman rather foolishly invited him back to his home. And I think sometime early in the morning, the Barrymore made an approach to the young boy. And this was found out before anything happened, I think. But it's kind of illustration of his lifestyle, just needing to fulfill himself with gay sex almost every night.
Well, Anthony, we are at 50 minutes. We've covered a lot of territory. Is there anything you would like to follow up with? Anything I missed? Anything you'd like to add?
I think I would like to just dwell slightly on the attempt by Piers Morgan to revive Barrymore's career again. Now, this is in two parts, really. First of all, Piers Morgan does a series on British TV called Life Story. And some months ago, Barrymore appeared on Life Story, and there was a long interview during which Barrymore was very lightly challenged by Piers Morgan, very light, and was anxious to portray Barrymore in as helpful a light as possible. And then in the lead up to this documentary, The Body in the Pool, there was an interview by Piers Morgan with Barrymore in front of a studio audience. And this is fascinating if you get a chance to view it. It's definitely up there on the internet. And Barrymore, he lies his way through what happened that night. But Piers Morgan is very deferential to Barrymore in this interview. At one point, Piers Morgan covers the subject of whether he gave drugs to Stuart Lubbock that night, and Barrymore seemed to get very agitated, And then Piers Morgan says, well, you were asked about that at the inquest. And Barrymore gets very agitated again. And he says, no, I didn't. He said, and in any case, my barrister told me that at an inquest, I wasn't allowed to, I wasn't compelled to answer questions about whether I've done anything illegal or not. So he then says, well, I just told the court that I didn't give him drugs. Now, he becomes very angry at that point, and Piers Morgan is then seen to back off, as if to say, look, I'm sorry I've upset you. Now, I didn't mean to upset you, but I've got to cover this difficult territory. But if you look at the whole interview, it is absolutely laden with soft-soaping Barrymore. And at one point he says to Barrymore, what do you think happened to Stewart? And Barrymore says, well, he drowned.
Wow. And those it's kind of a long form interview. Is that correct? It's kind of like he sits down for like an hour or something.
Yes. Yeah, that's it. That's it. Yes. And, Barrymore just, struggles to tell the truth and to stay calm. And, in the end, he almost shouts at Piers Morgan and says, look, I'm not just 99.9% innocent, I am 100% innocent. There is a pause, and then the audience applauds this courageous man for boasting that he's 100% innocent. So it's Piers Morgan is a man of some substance here. He is a prominent TV presenter, but on this occasion, he must know that Stuart Lubbock was raped to death. And yet he was prepared to virtually allow Barrymore to get away with pretending that Stuart drowned and that he really didn't know what happened to him. It was really quite disgraceful. And actually, if you look at the Twitter hashtag, Piers Morgan was ripped to bits by the British public for that interview.
Fascinating. Interesting. Yeah, well, we talked about in the pre-interview today, you know, I've watched Piers Morgan in action here with the West Memphis 3, where he just bungles the entire interview. It's a total softball interview and really an embarrassment. I actually have it on I have an analysis of it on my William Ramsey Investigates channel if you want to check it out. But if he covered for Barrymore, it wouldn't be the first time he'd covered for somebody involved in death, you know, in murder or something like that. Mm-hmm. Accidental otherwise.
But I mean, tell me this, how many bad people has Oprah Winfrey done soft soap interviews with?
She has. You should see her friends. They're terrible. She was friends with Harvey Weinstein. He went to jail for rape, just got convicted. Some of her friends are involved in all kinds of scurrilous stuff. It's off the charts. She was friends with that Yahweh of God guy who was literally raping women and selling babies and stuff, just abominations out of Brazil. So she never apologizes. She's still a hero, supposedly for women, but she likes people who are engaged in all kinds of vicious rapes and stuff. Yeah.
Why do millions of Americans watch her then?
I don't know. It's a mystery to me. Mm-hmm. I think that... I think they're naive and they're willing to look the other way about people's hypocrisies and contradictions, really. I mean, I don't know how a woman could look at this person who's friends with people abusing women, can get up and say that she's an avatar for women's rights and women's liberty and feminism or whatever she is. So.
One of the most notorious soft soap interviews she ever did was with the parents of Madeleine McCann. Did you ever see that one?
No, but I can imagine. Oh, man.
I mean, you know, the idea that Madeleine McCann was abducted, very few of us believe that here. We know that something else happened, but Oprah Winfrey helped them to dodge all the difficult questions. And of course, they just were able to get away unchallenged with all kinds of questions that should have been asked of them.
Yeah, I don't know how they get away with it. I know on smaller interviews, I've heard of stories where payments are made. Payments are made to the interviewer to do the interview and have a stop that the public never sees. You know, so I've heard of allegations of that happening.
I'm sure that's the case. I know that Oprah Winfrey has boasted of saying she never gets paid, but you can always you can always charge for expenses and this kind of thing, can't you?
But, an NDA, you know, if you have a binding NDA that has damages,
it should be arranged.
I mean, I'm not saying it happens all the time. I know of one instance on a very famous podcast where that was alleged, and it makes perfect sense because the person on there was, you know, it was more of like an advertisement for their position than a real interview. So, you know, that's not outside of the realm of possibility. But yeah, Piers Morgan, yeah, he didn't make it here. He tried to get on CNN. He had confrontations with people, and didn't really strike it rich with the American public. So I guess he just went back to the UK. Mm-hmm. Anyway, anything else you'd like to add, Anthony?
No. Thank you for covering it. I can't see this case being solved. Barrymore's got away with it. The others have got away with it. It would be a miracle if anybody comes forward. I'm just grateful, again, I would like to say to you and the people who've put up this documentary based on my interview with you, that at least has made me feel a little bit more that the story has got out. Because actually, I can't think of anywhere that it has. The material I discussed with you hasn't really been aired at all. So it's getting some coverage, and I'm happy about that.
Yeah, and it's a shame that book isn't out there for people to reference, because those first-person legal accounts and the compilation of all that material really allows people to see these cases with clarity and not through the lens of biased TV presenters or corporate media or people with an alternate agenda. Mm-hmm. And so...
I've got about 20 copies left, and if anybody checks on my Twitter account, Anthony Bennett, then my email address is on there. So,
So your Twitter is Anthony Bennett, correct? At Anthony Bennett.
It's Anthony Bennett at Zampos. ZAMPOS.
Gotcha. Okay.
ZAMPOS.
All right. So, anything else you'd like to add, Anthony, before we wrap it up?
No.
Okay, great. Again, it's Anthony Bennett. This is our third interview with Anthony, the first one about the details of the suspicious death of Stuart Lubick is from June 14th, 2019, which you can see on my podcast or my YouTube channel or anywhere at Opperman. It could just go out all over the internet. You can just type it into Google. You guys can check that out. But again, this was a follow-up to that original interview discussing with Anthony Bennett the documentary Body in the Pool, which can be found online, and also the newer documentary that Anthony was mentioning. I think you can see it. You can find a reference to it on your Twitter feed, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, great. All right, Anthony, thank you so much for the interview.
Okay, no, thank you.